This program is about unsolved mysteries. Whenever possible, the actual family members and police officials have participated in recreating the events. What you are about to see is not a news broadcast.
Christmas Eve, 1983. A freak snowstorm in Mexico spells disaster for a vacationing family from Atlanta, Georgia. Fortunately, an American couple, both apparently doctors, happened upon the scene and helped save the lives of at least five people. Perhaps you can help find these unknown Good Samaritans. All around the world, hundreds of people say they are being tormented 24 hours a day by a loud rumbling sound that almost no one else can detect. Could the source be a high-tech radio system used by the Navy to communicate with our submarine fleet? Meet Randolph Dial, sculptor, artist, convicted murderer. For 8 years, Dial did his time quietly and peaceably in Oklahoma's prison system. He became a model prisoner and even started an inmate arts program with a woman named Bobby Parker, the wife of a deputy warden. Then last August, Bobby Parker left her husband a note saying she had gone shopping. She never came home. Later that night, authorities discovered that Randolph Dial had somehow slipped away from the prison and vanished. Join me for this exciting and intriguing edition of Unsolved Mysteries. In addition, later in the show, we'll bring you a dramatic new update of a poignant case of lost love, solved thanks to you, our viewers. Imagine being plagued by this sound. A loud, annoying hum that grinds away incessantly, day after day, night after night. Incredibly, more than 1,000 people throughout the world are reporting just such a phenomenon, and it's driving them to distraction.
The thing I noticed about it was it didn't change. The sound didn't change, like it was getting closer or further away or slowing down or speeding up. It was just a steady, droning sound.
There is a little bit of a whine somewhere in the background here. And it's kind of like the air is sizzling.
I've been hearing the hum for about 5 years. It sounds like a diesel engine running parked away, but yet it has a physical effect. It seems to make a sound resonance in our sternum and our thorax area. It causes a vibration in the temporal lobe and actually causes ear pain at times and pain on the earlobes.
Hal Runianen moved from Detroit to Michigan's northern peninsula, hoping to escape the hustle and bustle of suburban living. But instead of peace and tranquility, Hal soon found himself tormented by the hum. It began as a minor annoyance while Hal was studying for a trade school entrance exam.
I noticed it a few times before I was studying, but thinking that it was a motor, it wouldn't bother me that much. But then I noticed it affecting how I could focus and how I could concentrate. That's when it really started agitating me. So I was able to ignore it maybe for the first month or two. But after a while, when I got closer to the deadline of this entrance exam, I started noticing this thing is really affecting how I'm studying. It's really affecting my thought process and how I'm taking in information. And it got to where I couldn't tolerate it anymore, and I had to know what it was. The first few nights I went out looking for it, I went to the natural places that you would think a hum was coming from. I checked out the sewage pumping stations, the airport, the ventilation systems on top of Michigan Tech University, any place that would generate a sound. Finally, I was driving like 100 miles a night in one direction looking for it. No matter where I went, the intensity was always the same.
Okay, I have a tuning fork, and I'm just going to sort of get an idea of how well your ears line up with each other. So the first...
We brought Hal to Los Angeles to visit Dr. Eugene Flom, one of the nation's leading ear, nose, and throat specialists.
In the middle of the head, where do you hear it?
Airplane.
Airplane.
Cowboy.
Cowboy.
Hal was found to be suffering some hearing loss, but there was nothing specific that might explain the bizarre hum.
Airplane, I don't know, I lost you.
From what we learned today, we can't prove one way or the other whether there are extraneous sounds in the environment or within him. Those sounds in the environment might be perceived by him differently than they really are because of things going on in his system.
I'm certain that I'm feeling something from an outside source. I'm a yoga teacher, a massage therapist, a rofer. I've studied acupuncture. I'm very aware of the sounds that my body makes, and I know this isn't my body producing this.
Many people have suggested that I might be picking up the electrical fields from the local power grid. So what I'd like to do is go down into the caves and get completely underneath it and see if I can get away from the electrical fields.
Hal has tried just about everything to escape the auditory onslaught, even braving the deep tunnels of an old abandoned copper mine near his home. Would Hal finally be at peace? We soon had our answer.
Yeah, I hear it.
What do you got?
I hear it louder. It's more penetrating. It's actually conducting through my bones more forcefully than it does on the surface.
You disappointed?
Very disappointing. I thought I could get away from it down under all this rock. It's worse.
This is a tape I developed as a simulation of the phenomenon as I experience it. I'm going to play it now.
Sarah Allen has been hearing the hum for 3 years.
Volume than I experience it at, but just so that you can hear kind of what it sounds like, that's what I'm going to do. Now, the volume level that I hear it at is much more like this. You bring it down to the minimum, and then you turn it up until you can just perceive it, which is right there. And that's how it's in my environment all the time. Whenever it's quiet, whenever there's a quiet moment, I'm in meditation or something, I have to share my space with this. And it's not comfortable.
Sarah Allen lives in Taos, New Mexico, which literally hums with activity. Since 1989, dozens of local residents claim to have heard the irritating sound. Sarah is a radio broadcast engineer. She first experienced the hum in 1992 after she'd been dispatched to repair a transmitter. It was Sarah's knowledge of electronics that later enabled her to recreate the noise so that non-sufferers would know exactly what it sounded like. We played Sarah's tape for Winona Whitted of nearby Santa Fe, New Mexico.
That's very close. Very, very close.
Tell me about it.
That's very close. It's quite a lot more pleasant than the jagged, grinding glass sensation that or sound that would come through.
For Winona, 5 years of constant humming has completely disrupted her life. She is currently on disability leave from her job with the National Park Service. Like many sufferers, Winona takes comfort in the knowledge that she is not alone. In no fewer than 10 countries, on 5 different continents, people have been hearing a similar low-frequency sound, most often described as a truck laboring up a hill. Today, many of the low-frequency sufferers belong to an international network dedicated to finding the cause of the hum.
We call ourselves hearers, but actually, we don't really feel like we're hearing. We feel like we're sensing. And none of us, we're not protesters or we're not activists. It's not like we want to take the day off of work and study physics and electromagnetic resonance, but it's driving us nuts, and we have the support and the exchange of information that we need with each other, and that's really been helpful.
We began to keep notes, not so much a logbook of every day, because it's there every day. You write in the log, it's there today, you know, and that's about all you can say about it. What we did start noticing was the intensity increases, which seem to track international events, mostly whenever the United States is involved militarily somewhere, the intensity seems to increase.
The hearers have come to believe that the hum may be caused by a radio system known as ELF, for extremely low frequency. The Navy developed ELF to better communicate with the nation's submarine fleet. When a sub is underwater, it cannot receive standard radio waves. However, low-frequency signals are capable of penetrating through hundreds of feet of water to reach vessels on the ocean floor. Perhaps not coincidentally, the system has been in use since the late 1980s, around the time that people in the U.S. first began to hear the hum.
I'm fairly convinced that it is military, not only because of my own research into it and my own reading and my own theories, but because of feedback I've gotten from scientists, from people in the armed forces or who have armed forces connections, and other people who I can't name, but who have come forward to me and who have pretty much verified my theories, at least in principle.
Recently, a team of scientists was commissioned to find the source of the hum. They traveled to Taos with some of the most sophisticated sound and radiation sensing equipment available. In the end, the scientists were unable to find anything dramatic or unusual at Taos that might explain the hum. However, they did conclude that the hum is a, quote, bona fide scientific mystery that deserves additional inquiry.
I'm hearing the hum now. And we have days where it oscillates on different sides, and today it seems to be oscillating more on the right side of my body. I don't believe how you can't hear it.
What is the source of the mysterious hum? Could it be ELF? Or is it possible that more than 1,000 people around the world are imagining the same thing? It is interesting to note that there is an ELF transmitting station just 80 miles from Hal Runyanen's house in Michigan. However, there is not a known station within 1,500 miles of Taos. For now, the hum remains a mystery for those who cannot hear it, and a major source of aggravation for those who can. On a previous broadcast, we brought you the poignant story of the Stallings family of Tipton, Oklahoma. A family so poor that in 1948, Lela Stallings, her husband, and their six children were forced to live in an old school bus.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you, Joseph.
In spite of the terrible hardships, Lela valiantly struggled to maintain a home life that was as normal as possible.
Thank you.
We always had something to do. And we had toys to play with and each other to play with. So we didn't think of ourselves as being different.
Based on evidence presented to this court.
However, the authorities felt otherwise. Lela and her husband were eventually charged with child neglect. The charges would later be dropped, but not before all of the Stallings' children were placed in foster homes. Two of them, Mary and Joe, were reunited in 1959. Since then, they have done everything possible to find their brothers and sister, only to be thwarted time after time.
I have tried every avenue that I have came before me to try and locate these brothers and sister. And I'll never quit until the last day of my life.
Unsolved Mysteries appeared to be the last hope. And happily, the day after our broadcast, 35 years of frustration came to an end for Joe and Mary. A man named Lee Shulian of Owosso, Oklahoma, called our phone center. He identified himself as Ernest Lee Stallings, who was only 5 when the family was split apart. Lee was thrilled to hear that his brother and sister were looking for him and was anxious to meet them.
Thank you.
3 weeks later, Lee arrived at a hotel in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to be reunited with Joe.
Hello.
The two brothers had not seen each other in nearly half a century.
Been talking to you on the phone quite a bit.
I've waited for this moment for so many
years. I know, that's what I heard.
I don't know how to describe it. It's such a wonderful feeling. Oh,
it's about time.
It's definitely time for this. Walking in this morning, he walked in, and we met, hugged each other. Nobody can realize the feeling.
We were separated too many years.
Yeah, about
47 years.
Yeah, 47, so. I really didn't know how I was going to react. We've been separated 46 years. I felt a lot better than what I thought I might. And I was really, felt real good to hug him.
We've already started making some plans to get together and go fishing. So we got a future ahead of us to be together and enjoy each other.
This picture here is you and I.
Sadly, Joe and Lee's sister Mary was unable to attend the reunion. However, she has spoken with Lee on the phone, and they plan to get together in the very near future.
My dad.
Right, yeah.
When we return, a family is rescued from a terrifying accident by two anonymous strangers. It is a traveler's worst nightmare. You are in a foreign country, driving along a dark, winding road with almost no visibility, and suddenly you lose control of your car. That exact scenario came horribly true for the Dover family of Atlanta, Georgia, some 12 years ago. They were in Mexico on their way to celebrate Christmas with relatives when the journey was cut short by an unexpected disaster. A disaster the Dovers miraculously survived thanks to the selfless heroism of two anonymous strangers. The adventure began 2 days before Christmas in 1983. Along for the trip were Joe Dover, his son Vance, his father-in-law James, cousin Tommy, Tommy's 7-year-old son David, and a close family friend, Mary Ann Prudente.
Turn around, sit down, please.
It was a real warm atmosphere. We were all, of course, we were all related. We were all friends. We talked and we ate in the van coming down. We played games and just really had a real warm time coming down.
I think Dad ate them all.
You're kidding.
Want some drink, Grandpa?
I got some.
You got some water? Oh,
thank
here you.
You
go. Hey, Tommy, how about some?
We had just purchased a new customized van, and it was loaded with everything. We had a television, and we had a refrigerator, so we were stocked up and just making an extremely good time and having a good time.
The drive from Atlanta to the city of Ciudad Victoria, Mexico, was about 1,200 miles. The Dovers hoped to complete the trip in 48 hours and arrive by Christmas Day. To save time, they stopped only for gas, and the adults took turns driving.
Now, we left on Friday afternoon, and we drove all day and all night. We got into Laredo, Texas, Saturday morning, which was Christmas Eve, and crossed the border. The further along we got, in the afternoon, it really began to get cold and began to snow.
The weather was getting really bad, and I had been to Mexico several times in the past, and I had never experienced anything like this in my life. It was extremely cold, rainy, snowy. It was just very uncharacteristic for the area.
By the time the Dovers crossed the border, Vance was behind the wheel. They were now an hour outside of Monterrey, the last major city before their final destination.
We were supposed to go over a mountain range to get to the city, and then we were diverted. There was a policeman in the road.
Hi!
Bueno!
We need to go to Monterrey.
Sí, por a la izquierda, entonces llega por allá.
With his father translating from the back seat, Vance learned that the main road through the mountains had been closed.
And we had to circle around the mountains and come into Monterrey from a more easterly direction. And the snow began to really pick up, and it was a real driving snow. It didn't one coming just straight down, and the sides of the road began to be coated. We could see it on the hills.
Hey, Vance, why don't you slow down a little bit here, buddy? It's getting a little bit slick out there.
Okay. We're trying to be extremely cautious because the road conditions were really getting pretty bad, and my father had just told me to even be extremely careful. And just moments after he had told me that, I suddenly lost control. I don't know how much time elapsed. I don't know how long I was out. I have no idea if it was 5 minutes or an hour, but I woke up. And it was just a matter of moments when someone opened the door and pulled me out. And the pain that I felt at that time was absolutely excruciating.
As Vance was pulled from the wreckage, he was unaware of the carnage surrounding him. The four occupants of the other vehicle had been killed instantly. Incredibly, the Dovers had all survived, though most of them were barely clinging to life. By the time Vance's father was pulled from the van, the rescue effort had been joined by a passing American couple, both of them apparently doctors.
My father, he was taken and put in the back of a pickup truck, as well as my grandfather. My grandfather had received just severe head injuries to the point of his skull was showing, his cut, his head was just cut really badly, and the doctors later told us that by him being put in the back of a pickup truck actually saved his life, because the cold weather actually helped seal up and clot the blood.
Through a haze of terrible pain, Vance watched the rescue effort unfold. He gradually realized that the two Americans had taken charge of the operation.
My cousin Tommy was pulled from the van, and his vital signs were taken, and it was assumed that he was dead.
Still not getting a pulse.
And they were pulling other people out and trying to revive the ones that they thought were still alive. After a few minutes had gone by, this doctor went and checked Tommy's vital signs again and found a very small pulse.
Vance now believes that if not for the woman's attention, Tommy would have died on the spot. A few moments later, she placed Tommy's son, David, apparently uninjured, in the car with Vance.
The lady then got in the back seat with me, and she was talking to me and comforting me, and I think she was trying to tell me what all had occurred, although at that time, I really just couldn't make it out.
The nearest clinic was in Monterrey, approximately an hour away. The unidentified American woman stayed by Vance's side during the trip.
The hospital I was taken into was unlike anything I'd ever seen before. It was, it reminded me almost like a MASH unit or something out of a war movie. There was this one nurse there, though. She spoke really good English. Her name was Alicia.
What? We are trying to help you. Can you tell me?
My leg.
And she told me that my leg was broken really bad.
You will have to put a pin in your knee.
And she told me that they didn't have any anesthesia, but they had to put it in traction. She said they were going to have to put a pin through my knee.
Are you Please calm down. We're trying to do everything we can to help you.
Where is everybody else? Where are the others?
There's a man and a woman and a child here.
The nurse was referring to Vance's cousin Tommy, his friend Mary Ann, and Tommy's son David.
We cannot...
The nurse told me that they were injured severely, they had head injuries, and she didn't think that they would make it through the night. There appeared to be no sign of my father and grandfather, and I had all kind of thoughts go through my head. I mean, they weren't at the hospital. I didn't know. Maybe they were taken to a morgue. I mean, I had no idea. And no one in the hospital knew where they were at.
Christmas morning dawned with a Christmas miracle. Vance awoke to find that his young cousin David had in fact escaped unharmed and that Mary Ann and Tommy were going to pull through. Vance was surprised to see that the mysterious woman, his guardian angel, was still with him.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
It brought a lot of joy to me knowing that she was there. And she brought us both a little Christmas present, and she spent Christmas morning with us there.
The woman raised Vance's spirits even higher when she assured him that his father and grandfather were still alive and being treated elsewhere.
They're going to be fine. They're at another clinic, and my husband is with them right now. You remember anything about last night?
I was driving.
She told me that her and her husband were on vacation, and they happened upon the accident just moments after it occurred.
I'm getting a pulse here.
I've always wondered what would have happened had they not come upon the accident, because we were an hour or so outside of this major city and there was nothing out there at all. And these people just showed up. Doctors showed up out of nowhere. And I believe they were extremely instrumental in saving our lives.
12 years later, the accident has had a profound effect on the entire Dover family. Today, they are all actively involved in the church. And in fact, Joe is a lay pastor with his own congregation of more than 300. Perhaps the most thankful of all is Joe's wife, Linda. She is convinced that had it not been for the two unknown angels, she might have lost her entire family.
I feel like it was a miracle. Many times there's an accident and, you know, we just drive by an accident. And they could have done that day, but they didn't. They stopped. And through their stopping, they saved the lives of our family. And we just want to say thank you.
A prison official's worst nightmare. An inmate who can charm the devil, who knows how to play the system, who harbors a deep but completely hidden desire to escape. Confessed murderer Randolph Franklin Dial was just such a man. Last August, Dial escaped from the Oklahoma State Reformatory, and he took 32-year-old Bobby Parker, the deputy warden's wife, with him. This is their story. It began in 1986. On videotape, Randolph Dial voluntarily confessed to committing a contract killing 5 years earlier.
He told me to get off of his property, and I pulled the piece out and fired once, hitting him approximately right here.
For nearly 8 years, Dial served hard time. But Randolph Dial was not your run-of-the-mill lifer. An artist of some repute before prison, he managed to hoodwink the guards and wardens in prison. Eventually, he was transferred to a minimum security unit at Oklahoma State Reformatory. There, Randolph Dial became the very definition of a model prisoner.
Randolph Dial was given trustee status.
He was given full run of the prison. In fact, as a trustee, even though he was under a murder conviction, he was given access to property outside the prison. There was really no supervision over Randolph Dial.
Dial's regular work assignment was caretaker at the home of Deputy Warden Randy Parker. Parker, his wife Bobby, and their two young daughters live right next door to the prison. Over the years, Bobby Parker had worked with a number of inmates as a volunteer for various rehabilitation programs. She and Randolph Dial were brought together when money was donated to start up a prison arts project.
What's a big push on it anyway?
Because we've got people wanting to buy these, Dial. I mean,
Dial often spent time alone with Bobby in her garage, which had been converted into a ceramic studio. Given the circumstances, it was not unusual when Dial developed something of a crush on Bobby.
I think that he probably read more into the working relationship than what was actually there. You know, a man's locked up for over 8 years, going on 9 years. He has a woman who is very attractive, very cordial, very compassionate, caring.
Well, I tell you what, Bobby, you just come right over here. You work side by side with me, we'll be on your schedule. What do you think about that?
I think you do your job and I will do mine and we'll meet at my schedule.
After a few weeks, Randy Parker began to feel that Dial was spending too much time with Bobby at the house and acting as if he controlled the arts program.
You need help over there?
I had told him, you screw up out here and I'll show you what administrative power is all about. And he was very much aware of that.
August 30th, 1994 began normally enough for Randy and Bobby Parker. First breakfast with their two daughters. Then Randy went to work next door and the girls headed off for school.
I love you.
Have a good day.
When Randy Parker left his house, Randolph Dial was already out front working in the yard.
Yeah, she gonna make me do this all day? She's got some other things lined up for me.
Just get back to work, Dial.
Trade jobs with you. Take it easy on them over there, sir.
At noon, Randy Parker came home for lunch, but found the house empty. There was a note from Bobby saying that she had gone shopping and that his sandwich was in the refrigerator.
It was not anything out of the ordinary at all to see a note there, let me know where she was, being concerned that I would be worried or having my lunch there for me.
Back at the prison, Randy Parker's day proceeded without incident. Then at 4:45, he received a troubling call from his older daughter.
Mom's not here right now.
She's not.
And I just came in and Brandy was sitting all alone on the floor.
Mommy's gone shopping. She'll be home real soon. Daddy'll be home in a little bit.
Okay, thanks, Dad.
Hi, sweetie.
Hi, Daddy. Mom still isn't home yet.
Randy Parker arrived at his house 30 minutes later. Bobby was still not there. Soon, Randy began to fear the worst.
Well, I guess she's still shopping. Listen,
He contacted the area hospitals, but there was no word of Bobby. At a loss, Randy rehashed the day in his mind.
Then I began to think back, you know, I hadn't seen Dial since this morning, and usually when I come home for lunch, he's usually there hanging out.
Yeah, hello, Captain Randy. Yeah, would you do me a favor, just clear Dial from his cell and send him over here now?
Tittle 2 to Tittle 1, be advised inmate Dial is not in his cell. Repeat, inmate Dial is not in his cell.
I knew at that point that Dial had escaped in the fear that he had taken Bobby, but yet I hadn't admitted that to myself yet.
Hello.
Mom, it's me.
Hi, Bobby.
Mom, listen, I need you to do me a favor.
Yes?
I need you to call up Randy.
All right.
Tell him and the children that I love them. It's all gonna be over soon, Mom. Mom, I gotta go.
Bobby, what are you talking about? Bobby, what's wrong?
I love you, Mom.
Bobby? Bobby!
And she hung up, and I knew immediately that she probably had been abducted, because my daughter wouldn't talk like that. She would have called her own girls and everything. She was not a crying person.
I didn't know what Dow was going to do, how he was going to harm her, hurt her, threaten her. And of course, I was worried sick about her, but then I was also worried, you know, how am I going to tell the girls?
The next day, Bobby called her best friend with the same message. The friend also felt that Bobby was being held against her will. Then, 24 hours later, Bobby's van was found abandoned just across the Texas border.
The vehicle was basically clean. We found no indications that a violent struggle had taken place in the vehicle. There were no blood splatterings at all. We did find cigarettes there, basic cigarettes, which was the brand that Randolph Dial smoked.
In the meantime, Randy Parker had learned from an inmate that for several months, Dial had been actively trying to barter for Valium on the prison black market. This fit with Randy Parker's firm belief that Dial had kidnapped his wife.
If he could have got some Valium to her in a glass of tea or something, then he picked her up and he walked her up to the van. And he laid her down in there and he took off. I believe that's what happened.
But the fact remained that there was no concrete evidence of a kidnapping. The authorities began to consider another possibility. Perhaps Bobby Parker had run away with Randolph Dial.
It does appear that there was a certain fascination that Randolph Dial had for Bobby Parker. From interviews with other inmates at the institution, he made comments indicating that he was romantically attracted to Bobby. We don't know if that was reciprocated in any fashion. At this point, we are under the assumption that she was taken against her will. We have no information to indicate otherwise.
My wife did not leave voluntarily with Dial. She did not fall in love with him. I believe that to the very depths of my soul, that is not even within the realm of possibilities that she would abandon two children, run off with an inmate who's convicted for murder, throw away everything that she's ever had. That's just not even possible. That is absurd and ridiculous.
Make us quick.
10 days after Bobby disappeared, she made one final phone call, this one to her brother's wife. Once again, Bobby sounded upset. She asked her sister-in-law to tell the girls she loved them and that everything would be all right.
And that was the last contact that anybody's had that I know of. That's been September 9th. That's been a long time, and I just keep waiting for another phone call, keep waiting for something, but Dial's not gonna let her call again.
Well, I personally painted all these ones you see here. I don't know if you saw.
There have been several sightings of Randolph Dial and a woman who may be Bobby Parker. One of the most credible occurred in September of 1994 at an art sale in Galveston, Texas. If the woman with Dial was indeed Bobby, she had either dyed her hair blonde or was wearing a wig. Witnesses say she seemed nervous and scared. Next, a businessman suspected of criminal activity disappears during a fishing trip. A tragic accident or a clever ruse to avoid arrest? The muddy, turbulent waters of the Colorado River snake some 1,500 miles through seven different states. Over the centuries, the Colorado's powerful currents have carved out hundreds of gorges, including the Grand Canyon in Arizona. But hidden by the river's majestic beauty is a world of untold secrets. Among them, the puzzling fate of a man named Robert Arcieri, who disappeared during a fishing trip on the Colorado more than 8 years ago. To all appearances, Bob Arcieri was a jovial, fun-loving family man who made friends at the drop of a hat. He was also the quintessential Wheeler dealer.
Oh, well, I got wonderful property. You just got north of Phoenix. Would absolutely suit you to a T.
In fact, around Phoenix, Arcieri was known as a man who could get you almost anything, from soft pretzels to camper shells. Bill Reddick knew him as well as anyone.
The first time I met Bob Arcieri was I went down and bought a camper shell from him. And then he needed some work done, I needed things done, and we just traded on and off. And I sold him a car that I had fixed, and our relationship just kind of rolled from there, from the rest of the time on.
Bill Reddick and his wife Janet hit it off with Bob Arcieri and his wife right from the start.
Hey, check out these little guys.
Oh, aren't those nice? That's our Kachina collection. Got some more.
Bob was fascinated by Bill's collection of rare Native American Kachina dolls worth $75,000.
Hey, you know, I also collect guns. I've got an 1881 Smith & Wesson. Would you like to see it?
Oh, I'd love to see that.
I'll go get it.
Great.
Bill was equally proud of his priceless antique guns. He left Bob in the living room while he went to retrieve them from the safe.
I had opened up my safe where they were at, and then I turned around and looked, and he's right behind me.
Oh, well, hey.
It seemed unordinary to me because I was going to get them out. The ones that I wanted to show him were just easy to pick up and bring in there, and I didn't do that.
Craftsmanship.
He was very calm and very cool about the whole issue. He didn't seem to be interested in anything. He just seemed to be more like, oh, that's nice, sort of like nonchalant.
On April 3rd, 1984, Bill Reddick was out of town on business. At around 8 p.m., his wife Janet came home from work. The house had been ransacked. The valuable Kachina dolls were laid out on a sofa and table.
I went to leave to get out of the house. From that point on, my memory is kind of black until I woke up in the hospital a couple days later.
With Janet unconscious, the thieves made off with the Reddick's entire collection of Kachina dolls, all of Bill's antique guns, and Janet's jewelry. Total value, more than $200,000. Janet had been struck 5 times in the head with a ball peen hammer. Miraculously, she would recover, but only after major surgery and months of rehabilitation.
Did they get much?
Well, they got the guns, they got the Kachina dolls.
While Janet was recuperating, Bob Arcieri stopped by to see how she was doing.
You're kidding, no. Mm-hmm.
Right, honey, at the time, the Reddicks just assumed he was a concerned friend, perhaps a little too concerned.
I didn't see anybody, huh? I didn't see anything.
He said to us that he was wishing he could help us find the guy, and if he did, he'd be glad to kill him for us.
There's three things that Bob was involved in. He was involved in drugs, he was involved in murder, and he was involved in robbery.
Almost 2 years later, this man, an admitted contract killer, went to the police with an incredible story. He claimed Bob Arcieri had masterminded a series of robberies, that the targets were Arcieri's own friends and business associates.
Would have dinner with these guys, have them over to their house, play golf with them, and then maybe 2-3 years down the road, he'd set them up.
We were initially a little skeptical of this information. However, as we began to investigate the crimes, this subject's story seemed very credible.
Phoenix police sought to verify the informant's allegations. They arranged for him to secretly tape record a conversation with Arcieri.
30 minutes ago.
Okay, don't forget to activate that thing we see him drive up.
Gotcha, man.
The meeting between the information source and Robert Arcieri took place in a parking lot. I was able to view the meeting through binoculars from some distance away.
We didn't talk about the job. I tell you, it was off. Let's go. Take a walk. Come on. Take a walk.
In the exchange, Arcieri canceled an alleged hit he had hired the informant to carry out.
It's off.
Come on, Bob. It's on. It's off. I've been spending a lot of time on this. So let's get it.
After we retrieved the recording device from him and listened to what was being said, it left little doubt that Arcieri was, in fact, involved in the crimes that the information source was alleging.
Janet, I brought some property with me. I'd like you to take a look at it.
The informant gave Detective Flick several items he said were stolen by Arcieri's henchmen.
I never thought I'd see these again.
Some of the valuables belonged to Janet Reddick.
Let me know if any of them are familiar to you.
Yeah, Robert Arcieri, yeah. Is he involved in this?
When I looked at the slip of paper and I saw Bob's name on it, everything just hit. This person is involved with what happened at my house.
Robert Arcieri was charged with 7 felony counts, including heading an organized crime syndicate, racketeering, and conspiracy to commit murder. But a few months later, in November of 1986, those charges were dropped while police continued the investigation. According to the authorities, they were gambling if they could build an even stronger case. Bob Arcieri was once again free to come and go as he pleased. In January of 1987, he set off on a fishing trip with his nephew and 2 friends. They chose a spot on the Colorado River known as Lee's Ferry.
Bob called me and he said he'd been exonerated and he wanted to celebrate. And that's why we went to Lee's Ferry, was to kind of celebrate that being all over and done with.
Ray Brown says that as darkness fell on the first day of the trip, Arcieri began to complain about chest pains.
Yeah, I'm gonna be fine.
Okay, I'm gonna go get the truck.
At the dock, Arcieri was the last man to disembark. His nephew had to help him from the boat.
Uncle Bob, your hand?
The other man on the fishing trip has asked not to be identified.
I walked up the dock and left the nephew and Bob standing there. And I went to the bathroom, and when I was leaving, I heard a splash down by the dock.
What happened? What's wrong? What's wrong?
I fell in the water.
Who did?
Uncle Bob. I don't know where
Uncle
he
Bob,
is.
Uncle Bob, what? What happened?
He was walking. He fell in the water. I don't know.
What did he do? Hit his head or something?
I don't know.
Well, where?
He's in the water somewhere.
The water was over a man's head at the boat dock. And I backed the truck up and shined the lights out on the river. And we could see nothing. And I knew he must be drowned.
In the area where Arcieri disappeared, the river broadens out almost into a lake. Rescuers feared that he may have floated a half mile downstream towards a set of powerful rapids. But an intense 4-day search yielded no trace of Bob Arcieri.
I feel that if he were in that upper section of the river in the clear water, there's a very high likelihood that we would have seen him in that area and he would have been found.
Did Bob Arcieri suffer a heart attack, fall into the Colorado River and drown? Or was the entire episode a clever ruse, enabling Arcieri to escape his impending legal troubles?
I feel that Bob Arcieri is dead. He was a family man out of this world. And going in that river, I just can't see any way he could have got out of it.
Bob probably didn't even get his feet wet. For all I know, the guys were with him threw a rock overboard. No, he's not dead.
It's my belief knowing that he was looking at spending the rest of his life behind bars resulted in him making some hard choices, and that was either facing them or feigning his death. And I believe he took the latter. Every indication I have is that he did not drown, and he is alive today.
Join me next time. Perhaps you may be able to help solve a mystery. Thank you.